Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, March 28th. Well, on Wall Street, I'd like to start out by quoting Rose Tyler, an American Idol fan. Rose said, "In the sucky economic climate we're in now, I like having TV to cheer me up." That's what Rose said upon learning her favorite show was preempted by President Obama's press conference Tuesday night. Rose, we all want TV to cheer us up. But Ms. Tyler, if she holds any equity, should be feeling a little better after the histrionics of the prior week. In fact, a new USA Today Gallup survey reveals that 29% now believe the economy is getting better, the best such reading since July 2007. Granted, 66% still believe it's getting worse, but it's a start. It's the stock market. Specifically, since the lows of March 9, the impact of the fastest 20% rally just 13 trading days since 1938. It was at the height of despair in my column of March 7 that I felt compelled to defend my increased optimism in terms of my asset allocation, moving from 20% equities, 80% cash to a 50-50 split at year-end. While the market took a breather on Friday and yet could slump anew, I think I've proved my point that you have to constantly separate sentiment from the fundamentals, or at least keep it in the back of your mind when you are making any kind of investment decision or forecast. I've long felt this market would turn well before the economy did. That's simple market history, after all, and this time will be no different. For now, though, I see no reason to go crazy and or increase my allocation further. Because for one thing, we have this little issue of North Korea and a rather large bottle rocket sitting on a launch pad over there. Should they indeed fire it this week, they've pegged April 4 to 8. There isn't a single person on Earth who truly knows what would happen next. Hopefully the little urchins pull back from the brink. Back to the week of March 16, the week from hell when it came to democracy in America and our beloved Constitution that was being trampled on by a bunch of idiotic elected officials. Thankfully, this past week, cooler heads prevailed, which was no small reason for the performance in the market and perhaps a few less sleepless nights across our land. Even Senator John McCain said what we had witnessed was as explosive in a short period of time as anything I've ever seen. Following some additional commentary, looking back before we tackle the latest issues to emerge, Thomas Friedman, New York Times. I ran into an Indian businessman friend last week, and he said something to me that really struck a chord. This is the first time I've ever visited the United States when I feel like you're acting like an immature democracy. You know what he meant. We're in a once-a-century financial crisis, and yet we've actually descended into politics worse than usual. There don't seem to be any adults at the top, nobody acting larger than the moment, nobody being impelled by anything deeper than the last news cycle. Instead, Congress is slapping together punitive tax laws overnight like some banana republic. Our president is getting in trouble cracking jokes on Jay Leno, comparing his bowling skills to a Special Olympian. And the opposition party is behaving as if its only priority is to deflate President Obama's popularity. Right now, we have an absence of inspirational leadership. From business, we hear about institutions too big to fail, no matter how reckless. From bankers, we hear about contracts too scared to break, no matter how inappropriate. And from our immature elected officials, we hear about how it was all the other guy's fault. I've never talked to more people in one week who told me, you know, I listen to the news and I get really depressed. So wrote Thomas Friedman. Well, Barack Obama did come through on 60 Minutes when asked by Steve Croft about the AIG bonus hysteria and the reaction in the House to levy a 90% punitive penalty on compensation above $250,000. We can't govern out of anger, said our president, and that simple statement went a long way in calming the waters. That and, in fact, all manner of more mature senators from both parties echoed similar sentiments on the Sunday talk shows last week. But we do have a tough road ahead, particularly when it comes to a critical piece of the bank puzzle dealing with toxic debt, where the U.S. Treasury is financing up to $1 trillion to purchase distressed assets in a public-private partnership. George Will said on This Week, why partner with this government, one that goes around abrogating contracts? Why partner with a government that, in the words of New York Times columnist Frank Rich, allowed AIG to launder $170 billion in taxpayers' money by paying off its reckless partners in gambling and greed? From Goldman Sachs and Citigroup on Wall Street to Societe Generale and Deutsche Bank abroad. The week of March 16, AIG's bonuses were the prime issue, but this past week, what increasingly riled some of us up was the realization that our money has been flowing through, 100 cents on the dollar, to the likes of Goldman in order to honor contracts with AIG. Sounds honorable at first blush, but upon further reflection, why are we once again bailing out these institutions, Goldman in particular? I noted last time how comfy it was to have former Goldman CEO Hank Paulson as then Treasury Secretary and a former Goldman board member, Ed Liddy, in place at AIG to clean the mess up. But why weren't we raising more hell about this going back to last year? Pretty simple, sports fans. There was no freaking transparency. We didn't know until just the past 10 days who the heck was getting tens of billions of our money. Forget the bonus issue. As much as Congress deserves grief, the letter they just sent to the Inspector General for the Troubled Asset Relief Program asked the right question. Was any attempt made to renegotiate and close out these contracts with the counterparties with haircuts? If not, why not? Katya Whitehouse of the New York Post had a piece on Goldman CFO David Vinier defending the company's acceptance of $12.9 billion as payment for bets made. Vinier said, "We don't think we did anything wrong. We had commercial terms. It is our responsibility to our shareholders to make sure that we are protecting ourselves. That's why we enter into these contracts." Ms. Whitehouse said, Vinier downplayed the notion that Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein had the ear of then-Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, who was Blankfein's predecessor at Goldman. Well, of course he would. Michael Lewis, Bloomberg. "I doubt seriously we will ever understand the morality of the $173 billion payment. That is the far more serious issue. For instance, Goldman Sachs, which received about 8% of the pile, or $13 billion, has claimed publicly that the money was, to them, a matter of indifference, as Goldman had hedged itself against a possible collapse of AIG by making bets against AIG. This suggests that it was clear to at least one market player before the collapse that AAA-rated AIG was behaving in ways that might lead to its demise, which is to say that there was really no responsible place to lay off these bets. So why bail out those who made them?" Lewis continues, "It also suggests that it is a matter of indifference to Goldman Sachs whether AIG lived or died, as either way it was protected. So why bail it out? Since the beginning of the crisis, I've wondered," says Lewis, "why the government has found neither the will nor the way to attack the root of the problem, the people who borrowed money to buy homes they shouldn't have bought. Now I think I understand. It would be too simple. People would understand a lot of small payments to the guy down the street who doesn't deserve them and become outraged. Far better to throw trillions at opaque corporations, the inner workings of which no one still really understands." That was Michael Lewis. Or as I'm fond of saying, corruption makes the world go round. Paul Krugman on the Public-Private Investment Program. "The common elements to the Paulson and Geithner plans is the insistence that the bad assets on banks' books are really worth much, much more than anyone is currently willing to pay for them. In fact, their true value is so high that if they were properly priced, banks wouldn't be in trouble. And so the plan is to use taxpayer funds to drive the prices of bad assets up to fair levels. Mr. Paulson proposed having the government buy the assets directly. Mr. Geithner instead proposes a complicated scheme in which the government lends money to private investors, who then use the money to buy the stuff. The idea, says Mr. Obama's top economic advisor, is to use the expertise of the market to set the value of toxic assets. But the Geithner scheme would offer a one-way bet. If asset values go up, the investors profit, but if they go down, the investors walk away from their debt. So this isn't really about letting markets work. It's just an indirect, disguised way to subsidize purchases of bad assets." Paul Krugman continues, "The real problem with this plan is that it won't work. Yes, troubled assets may be somewhat undervalued. But the fact is that financial executives literally bet their banks on the belief that there was no housing bubble and the related belief that unprecedented levels of household debt were no problem. They lost that bet, and no amount of hocus pocus, for that is what the Geithner plan amounts to, will change that fact. Even more important is the way Mr. Obama is squandering his credibility. If this plan fails, as it almost surely will, it's unlikely that he'll be able to persuade Congress to come up with more funds to do what he should have done in the first place. All is not lost. The public wants Mr. Obama to succeed, which means that he can still rescue his bank rescue plan, but time is running out. That was Paul Krugman. Both Krugman and economist Nouriel Roubini still look for bank nationalizations as the crisis deepens. Turning to the economy, the figures for the U.S. this week were solid. Durable goods for February were up 3.4% when a decline was expected, and the numbers on new and existing home sales are both better than expected, thus continuing a trend in this regard. While the housing sector is still in a deep depression, there are distinct signs of a bottom. In California, for example, median home values, now generally off 30 to 40% from their peak, seem to have stabilized with buyers entering the market, even if many of the sales are for foreclosed properties. It's all part of the process. Josh, my West Coast Maven, notes that sales in San Diego County have risen 8 straight months, year over year, after a whopping 48 consecutive months of decline. Median price in San Diego is actually off 45% from the peak. One thing I've noticed in reading my own local real estate listings in New Jersey is that I'm increasingly finding myself thinking, gee, the price for the property seems reasonable. Long-time readers and listeners of me should find that kind of startling, seeing as I was crying about how overvalued real estate was long before 99% of the rest of the world. Last September, I said housing as measured by the median home price would bottom this coming April, May, and while I was a little uncertain with this prediction earlier this year, I will be right. Just remember, I also said and maintain that when we hit the bottom, there is no V-shaped recovery. We just sit there for a while. Globally, in the month of February, exports in Japan plunged 49%. Toyota says February sales declined a full 50%, while Honda's rough 42%. It was the worst performance for exports across the board in Japan since 1957, when the first Godzilla movies were being filmed with an erector set in a large bathtub. Retail sales in Japan fell a whopping 5.8%, and wages are falling furiously. Deflation is back. But in China, there are signs housing is stabilizing. Actually, one report I read said home sales were surging thanks to the nation's stimulus plan. But as with everything else here, I'd like to see some follow-through. In Germany, Commerzbank is estimating GDP will fall 6 to 7% in 2009, far worse than the government's own projections, while in UK, retail sales fell 1.9% in February. World Trade Organization continues to forecast a total collapse in global trade this year, down 9%, the worst year ever, after rising a slim 2% in 2008. Germany remains the number one exporter, by the way, followed by China and the United States, with the U.S. still far and away the leading importer. But with all the dire news on the production front, there is a silver lining. Store shelves are running increasingly bare as everyone slashes inventories. Ergo, you don't have to be an Einstein to figure out that eventually these inventories will need replacing. Stocks rallied for the third straight week, with the Dow Jones rising 6.8% to 7776, though it's still down 11% for the year, while the S&P 500 added 6.2%, and NASDAQ finished ahead 6% to 1545. After Thursday's close, NASDAQ was actually up for 2009 before stumbling Friday. The culprit on Friday was the meeting 15 bank chiefs had at the White House. Despite the polite comments afterwards, it was clearly a bit of a tension convention as President Obama struggles with the compensation issue, while the bank heads said they are tired of being beaten up by Democrats. It didn't help matters that Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase and Ken Lewis of Bank of America, two had helped launch the rally a few weeks back, when they said business had been strong in January, February, conceded March was looking rather dismal. And even with the firmer tone the past 3 weeks, there are justifiable concerns over coming earnings reports. The rally cannot last unless market participants believe analysts have underestimated earnings potential for the second half. Should current forecasts be right, however, it's tough to rationalize existing valuations. Have a great week. I'll be back next Saturday.